Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I think we really need to understand violence against women as a political issue, and that we need to understand that we need to remove it from a private matter into a public matter. We need to understand what role the state plays in enabling and supporting violence against women.
That's the voice of Dr. Donna Alwyn. Dr. Donna Alwyn today speaks about how the Harper government uses women to justify its foreign and domestic policies. So stay tuned.
We are very privileged to be speaking with Dr. Donna Alwyn. She's an assistant professor of gender studies and cross-appointed to the Department of Cultural Studies at Queen's University. Very happy to have you on our show. Dr. Alwyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sylvia, for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the airwaves.
An article you've written titled Bodies That Matter in Death, Honor Killings and Canadian Racial Logics. In your article, you talk about honor killings. What is honor killings?
In my argument, I see honor killings as part of violence against women, understood very broadly. However, many feminists and many international organizations, as well as the Canadian government, have been arguing that honor killings are, in fact, distinct from violence against women broadly defined, and they argue that the reason that honor-based violence is distinct, that there are three reasons why honor-based violence is distinct from violence against women. One is that honor-based violence often occurs within a framework of collective family structures, so it's usually the family deciding to punish a woman for example, performing excessive acts of sexuality or going against the honor code or the cultural codes of her family. That's one element as to why people argue that honor-based violence is different than violence against women. And then the other issue is that it often involves a premeditated act. So it's not something, it's not just, for example, a crime of passion. It's something that happens because people have planned it. And then the third is that honor killing emerges from this right, this putative right of men to control women's sexuality. And that's what's different about honor killings as opposed to violence against women. My argument or how I view it is a bit differently because I do not necessarily see them as distinct. And in fact, I see it as very dangerous to set apart or aside honor killing from an understanding of violence against women in patriarchal, white supremacist, heteronormative cultures.
That's such an important point to make because violence against women is not only an attempt to normalize, you know, violence in society, but it's also a political phenomenon with an intent to keep women in constant fear.
Totally.
I wonder if you could expand on that and talk a little bit about the significance this has, in particularly the way we stereotype the role of women, particularly women of Arab descent.
Right. Well, your question is so fascinating and interesting. I mean, I think we really need to understand violence against women as a political issue, and that we need to understand that we need to remove it from a private matter into a public matter. We need to understand what role the state plays in enabling and supporting violence against women. And if we don't do that, how else can we understand the government's lack of attention and lack of concern for the missing Native and Aboriginal woman and the murdered sisters? What do we make of that? We need to understand violence against women that happens in the private sphere as intimately linked to violence against women that happens in society at large, and violence that is sanctioned by the state and its approach to gendered bodies and women's sexuality. So there's that kind of concept and issue there. The other part that you bring up in regards to Arab women and even Muslim women's sexualities, I want to say that honor killings in Canadian parlance is something very new. We've mostly seen neutral language in regards to crimes that are committed by men that are perceived to be Muslim or racialized in particular ways. When they, when these crimes have happened, the state has been very reluctant to use the term honor killings. But the conservative government under Harper has completely changed and switched gears. And now we see more and more a willingness and even a desire to label and target what the government sees and views as honor killings. So now we know that it's definitely part of a larger, broader political project that the state is involved in naming and also targeting particular people whose cultures are viewed as not necessarily fitting in within the Canadian cultural or multicultural mosaic. And one example that I can give of that is the fact that under Minister Kenney, for example, who's also the Minister of Citizenship and Multiculturalism in Canada, there has been a new citizenship guide produced. And the new citizenship guide, which is the guide that immigrants are supposed to read when they come to Canada, it actually includes a statement against honor killings. And it warns immigrants that Canada does not welcome nor tolerate violence against women, especially violence against women that includes cultural traits or cultural habits like honor killings or stoning or female genital mutilation. So how we come to separate these three or target these three and separate them from a broader understanding of violence against women is definitely a political and politicized project, and it's very much intimately tied to how this society wishes to view and look at Arab bodies or Muslim bodies or racialized bodies in Canada.
That's such an important statement. Growing up during the war in El Salvador, I think of the many wars that are fought and how they tend to be justified or legitimized. The violence is legitimized by saying we're protecting women and children. And so women become the banner under which the wars are fought. In Afghanistan, we're now told the Canadian troops are fighting to bring democracy and to liberate women. How would you describe this war?
It's fascinating to look at the rhetoric surrounding how women's bodies also become battlefields, right? For example, you talk about Afghanistan, and that's such an important thing to talk about because Canadians often forget that we are involved in an occupation in Afghanistan that's completely ongoing, and that this occupation, you know, that we have naturalized and made into transformed in our understanding as a project of peacekeeping is often fought or supported through this idea that Canadians are now helping Afghani Muslim women and liberating them from the Taliban and from this Islamic culture that inhibits them. So I want to say a couple of things about that. Obviously, we know for a fact that that kind of logic is very much supported and has been touted by American presidents. Even Laura Bush can now say things like, I'm a feminist because I support the right of Afghani women, and we are going into occupation of Afghanistan because we want to support and free and liberate Muslim women from the Taliban. And I want to say that if that were true, we would have been paying attention to what Afghani women who had been living under the Taliban, who have been very active in trying to overthrow and bring attention to their dilemmas and their lives under the Taliban, have been completely ignored until it was strategically useful for empire to look at these lives. So we know of, for example, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, who had been talking and writing and citing cases and saying, look, life under the Taliban is hell, and no one is doing anything about that. And then what we see is, after September 11th, all this increased interest in taking these stories and absorbing them in order to justify imperial ambitions and desires. So that's the American kind of side of it. And in Canada is not free from that discourse and rhetoric. Canada, too, uses and enables its occupation through and on the bodies of Muslim women in Afghanistan. So we have associations in Canada that receive funding from the government. There are women's associations Americans who are saying that we're going to be working or trying to raise literacy for women in Afghanistan, and they receive large amounts of funding while they are based here in Canada, and while they are usually white women who go back to Afghanistan or go to Afghanistan for the first time in their lives and receive very little cultural or educational or geographic or historical understanding of the situation in Afghanistan, and yet they come back and say, oh, look at us, we are building schools for Afghani women. These kinds of efforts need to be scrutinized, and we need to be looking at them very critically to understand, A, how money is being spent, who's being funded, and why, and how that funding goes hand in hand with empire's logic and with empire's ambition.
It's interesting how journalism and education are the two institutions that have served to socialize a particular worldview and how we understand and see the world. Talk a little bit about the role you see the corporate commercial media playing in the propagation of particular myths and stereotypes of Arabs and Muslims, and how does this serve the intent of imperialism and hierarchies of domination that we also live under here in Canada?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I mean, as you know, the Arab world has gone through these major, major political and social changes, and ones that we don't entirely know the consequences of them and what they're going to be, what the Arab world is going to look like in the next couple of months, maybe years, even maybe decades. But what has happened is we started seeing these images of Muslim women that really completely confound Western understanding of questions of agency and empowerment. So, for example, we would see an image of a completely veiled Muslim Egyptian woman, and not just veiled, not just head covering, but also her eyes are covered. And that woman would be carrying a sign saying, Mubarak, I want you out. So we see her exercising her right to political freedom and speech, and we know that she is an active person, a person who's completely, standing in solidarity with these protesters. And so what happens is you get these images, and you think, for years, I have thought that Muslim women cannot express their opinions or do not have an opinion of their own, or that men do not allow them to express their opinions. And then you have that kind of image and you try to juxtapose them with one another. What you have is actually very revealing, because it tells you that our whole understanding, our whole Orientalist understanding of Muslim women and Arab women in particular, is very much a part of a larger project to see and say that the West remains the beacon of freedom for women, and therefore women in Western countries like Canada can look over there to try and save their brown or Muslim sisters from brown men, without looking inwards to see how patriarchy and its logic and to understand its ramifications here in Canada. So I mean, this is such an important time, because the gender studies classroom or the feminist project can no longer function in the way that it has, because now we have ample proof, not that we never did, but now with the media revolution, we know that these images exist everywhere. We see these women speaking, we see pictures of them going into demonstrations, we see them sleeping outside in public, and we see them working hand in hand with men from their society and trying to bring down a despotic regime. So they're no longer confined in our imagination to the household or to the veil. So that's been really, really fascinating to witness.
The attack on public service, particularly in Canada, seems to me to be an attack directly on women as well. Many of the public servants, particularly teachers, tend to be women, a profession that has been genderized. Talk a little bit about the resistance, the struggles that we face to overcome the constant propagandization of, anti-union sentiment and that divides us, and rather than recognizing that our efforts are to be aligned with those who are working, whether our teachers or in other fields. But really, what we need to realize is that those obstacles that we're facing here in Canada are real to us. Instead of trying to figure out how to save other people in other parts of the world, they seem to be able to do it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you you're talking about public servants, and I'm thinking honestly in about our job in the gender studies classroom, in the higher education classroom. Like, what is our role in terms of getting our students to realize that, you know, there is a lot of feminist, anti-sexist, anti-racist work that needs to be done here, and instead of, you know, continually gazing over there, we actually need to focus on what's happening. And I think one way that we can do that is to, for example, look at the language and parlance that's coming out of the Conservative government regarding women. Look at what kind of funding is being cut. Look at how the Sisters of Spirit, for example, have been completely denied funding that is crucial for their work on missing and Native women, and, you know, lobby the government to try and get back that money, or at least expose the hypocrisy of a government that is, you know, denying that work from taking place, while at the same time saying we are going to be dedicating $2 million to any kind of organization that wants to help us fight honor crimes in Canada. So I think that we need to start gazing inwards in order to expose the hypocrisy of this regime that is actually very much anti-woman and very much anti-feminist, even though it has at its vanguards and at its front lines women who are pretending to be speaking on our behalf and who pretend to be, you know, representing us. So I see the battle as very much internal, and part of my work is trying to expose those kinds of inconsistencies and hypocritic moments, and trying to talk about, you know, what it means to be living as a woman, as a Canadian woman, a racialized Canadian woman in this time under the Conservative government of today.
What inspires you to keep struggling in spite of, you know, the many barriers we face as racialized bodies in this society?
I really believe that, you know, change is around us. Our struggle is ongoing. It's not gonna, it's gonna take years, times, and, you know, decades, and it may not happen that we will necessarily reap the benefits of our work right now. But I really believe that change is all around us. If you look at the Egyptian people who lived under a despotic and autocratic regime for 32 years and were able to say enough is enough and have come to bring down that regime and continually challenge whatever authority has taken place since then, that's a sign that change can happen, that and that, you know, we can imagine a different and a better reality for ourselves. And, you know, I'm inspired by things that are happening out there, and I'm also inspired by things that happen here. I'm inspired by my students who are doing amazing work and challenging feminist understanding, Western feminist understanding in the classroom, and trying to take what we do in the classroom into the world. So these small and big moments are things that inspire me, and this hope for change, and not false hope in the Obama kind of post-racial vision of hope, real hope that things can change and will change if we wish to make them change.
Tell us about your talk. It's titled Bodies That Matter in Death, Honor Killings in the Canadian Racial Logics.
So my talk is actually exposing some of the work that I was just, and some of the ideas that I started discussing with you today. But what I'm trying to argue in that paper is that in Canada, there are bodies, there are racialized women's bodies and gendered bodies that come to matter simply by virtue of their death. And so what I'm trying to argue in that, and I know this is a difficult argument to grasp, and part of it, what I'm trying to say is, why is it that the government is so concerned with honor killings at this point in time rather than violence against women? The government tells us that between 2001 and 2011, in this decade, there's been 11 to 12 deaths called honor killings that the government can describe as honor killings. So I want to know, why is this focus and attention being drawn to these 12 deaths? And why is it that these bodies come to signify only when they are dead? Part of my argument is that that it's not a coincidence that these bodies come to signify only in death, and that that's part of how these racialized and gendered bodies fit within the logic of the nation state, the Canadian nation state.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. Have a great day.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
We're going to close out the show with the song Drop of Water by Dana Lyons.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle is flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Thank you.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.